Here, I'd like to speak about work that's in collaboration with my graduate student, Cameron Gibbelew. He's getting a PhD in April this year. And one interesting thing about Cameron is that he actually was a teaching assistant, we call it GSI, graduate student instructor, in five different departments at University of Michigan. And you can ask yourself, how is it even possible to teach in five departments when you're... He loves teaching, and he is a good researcher as well. Yes, it was physics and astronomy to start with. Then it gets more sketchy. English, history, and psychology. And it wasn't physics for those people. It was also, there's something called the Big History Project, Bill Gates funded. And that's kind of a generic, one of those general things too. Yeah, so I'm fuzzy on the details, but. So in this talk, I will talk more generally about how to test fundamental physics with large-scale structure. I'll review something called CMB anomalies, which is somewhat of a motivation for this, but not really, and how to test them. But really, the main topic is constraining dipoles in a large-scale structure. Now, many, you know, lots of interesting things in physics can be large-scale structures distribution of galaxies in the universe. And, you know, many things can be obtained from the distribution of galaxies. We all know about this. Of course, properties of cold dark matter. Expansion history, for example, baryonic acoustic oscillations have to do with clustering of galaxies, and expansion history tells us about dark energy. Modified gravity, of course, both in the context of dark energy and in the context of dark matter. Then self-interactions of dark matter. Neutrino masses, there's a really phenomenal limit to the sum of masses from the large-scale structure, mainly, that's less than 0.3 eV or so. And this number, if you haven't followed, has been improving steadily. And will improve further to the point where it'll be small enough, it'll be able to test the neutrino hierarchies. Features in the inflationary potential, something that was a big topic the last few years, primordial non-Gaussianity of density fluctuations, and large-scale structure plays a very important role in these tests. But I won't talk about that. I'll talk about statistical isotropy of the universe and how just this one out of many topics that can be tested with large-scale structure. This is a simulation, not of all of the large-scale structure, one galaxy cluster done by my postdoc, Heidi Wu, at University of Michigan. This is formation of just about the biggest object we have in the universe today, 10 to the 15th solar mass cluster. There are about 10 million particles here, and each particle is about 10 to the 8 solar masses. And you can see this starts at redshift of 15, ends today. You can see the signature, these little, you can call them subhalos. These are clumps within the big clump of a cluster. Whose distribution and properties people are studying from observations and from simulation. And then, of course, there's all of the large-scale structure, which I'm not showing here, which is many of these clusters. They're interconnected by filaments. Then there's pancakes and so on. So there's a large-scale structure in the near future will mean a billion of order billion galaxies. These are very rough numbers. Of order 10 million of them with spectra, so redshifts. Of order a million quasars, and of order 100,000 galaxy clusters. And both together and separately, these things tell us a lot about the universe. So Moore is really different here. A colleague of mine in physics at Michigan tells me the story of an unnamed astronomer from our astronomy department who, prior to Sloan Digital Sky Survey, before that was starting and got all the constraints of cosmology, this astronomer was asking, really, you have to ask yourself, why do you need a million galaxies? What can you do with a million that you cannot already do with 1,000? Of course, we know you can do a huge amount with a million that you can't do with 1,000, like do all of those tests I showed before. But now, actually, there's things you can do with a billion that you can't do with a million. Right? So this is becoming very powerful. It's three-dimensional, of course. And so you can, of course, do the general astrophysics with this, which is all kinds of things astronomers are interested in. And you can do the kinds of things I mentioned that cosmologists are interested in. And I think one of the main sort of efforts and directions now and especially in the future will be the treatment of systematic errors and how they affect cosmology, taking care of them so that you can maximize cosmological constraints. So let me talk a little bit about statistical isotropy. Typically, if we have any field in the sky, it can be temperature distribution in the CMB or, you know, galaxy distribution in the sky projected. Any function on the sphere, we can describe in terms of these spherical harmonics and coefficients ALM. Statistical isotropy means that a two-point correlation function of these coefficients ALM is diagonal in L and in M. So it's only depends on one parameter L and not L prime, M, and M prime. Gaussianity, on the other hand, which is sometimes kind of confused with this, is a little bit different. It says a three-point and five-point and all those higher functions that are odd point correlation functions are zero in expectation. So a few more things about statistical isotropy. This is very basic. So statistically, isotropic means that the two-point correlation function of that field only depends on an angle between points n and n prime, and not on those actual points. So this principle we use 99.99% of the time in cosmology, because basically it allows us to average, for example, for a single L, you have two L plus one M modes, and you can average those and get much, much better constraints on cosmological parameters that you would without withdropping. You know, withdropping statistical isotropy, you wouldn't get much. So we assume this a lot of the time, but there's no fundamental reason why statistical isotropy has to be obeyed by our universe. And in fact, there are reasons why it would be violated. So let me talk a little bit about these CMB anomalies that there is some evidence for some anomalies from the WMAP data. I'll just review this very briefly. This is not the topic of my talk. So not in any particular order also. The first set of things has been goes back to WMAP first year data. And it's been noticed that if you filter the sky, the temperature sky, only for the quadrupole and octupole, so only these largest modes, the plane, first of all, quadrupole and octupole have power in a certain plane. That plane is nearly perpendicular to another special plane on the sky, which is the ecliptic plane, trajectory of the sun. Those two planes are nearly perpendicular, and you can see that by defining suitable normals to the quadrupole and octupole plane, and there's four normals. It turns out there's one normal for the quadrupole, and three normals for the octupole. It turns out that the octupole defines three planes. And all four of those planes are nearly perpendicular to the plane of the ecliptic. All right, there's that. And also the ecliptic threads between the big hot and cold spot in the CMB very finely. So there seems to be some alignment there. Actually, not some, a lot of alignment. The other potentially unrelated thing has been noticed going way back is has to do with the fact that the southern hemisphere in the CMB has more power than the northern. Now, this is not galactic southern and northern. This is almost exactly ecliptic southern and north. So here's ecliptic south. Here's ecliptic north. At higher multipoles, south has more power. You might be able to see that by looking at the power spectrum out of some multiples. This is from an older paper. So the south is dotted. The north is solid. Then there's the total, and you can kind of see by eye that south has more power. When you do the analysis, you find that. However, this evidence depends on which multiple you stop. And the most complete work in that regard, to my knowledge, is this Hansen and Lewis paper, where they have looked at this as a function of L max, multiple at which you stop. And here's three maps. One is out to L of 25, out to 64, out of 100. And this tells you where the south pole of this hemispherical division is and roughly what the error is. And you can kind of see by eye that south has more power than the north at L of 64. But when they did the sliding scale as a function of L max, they found that the amplitude of this modulation, which I haven't defined, I'll define it in a little while. So let me just kind of wave my hands at this point. The amplitude, if this is a real signal, you expect this to flatten off, the evidence to flatten off or maybe even increase at some as you go to smaller and smaller scales. But in fact, if you look at these solid lines, the evidence keeps dropping. And this is the evidence in percent, you know, low in this lower panel means high evidence. And you see it just happens that at a point where people decided to stop previously at L of 64, there's good evidence for something. But in fact, as you know, as you look at higher resolution maps, you don't see any particular evidence for this. So it might just be a fluke. There's no good evidence for this. But anyway, that's, you know, people have been talking about this. Then there's also potentially unrelated thing, which is the fact that power above 60 degrees in the CMB is very nearly zero. So the blue, this is the two-point correlation function, C of theta as a function of angle. This is in real space as a function of theta. And usually you don't see this graph. You look at the CLs. Here all points are correlated. The blue is the expectation from lambda CDM theory. And the red is measurement from the cut sky maps, which is maps where the galaxy has been removed. If you actually look at the full sky maps, you get something that doesn't quite look the same. But it's really the cut sky. You know, it appears that the full sky actually brings in some power from the galactic plane. But if you explicitly remove galactic plane, this power is consistent with flat out zero above 60 degrees. This has been discussed in the literature, very technical points like which estimator should you use and all that stuff. So this, why is this special in my mind? Because it is the largest observed scales, not any random range of scales picked by hand, but largest observed scales above 60 degrees. So this could be a signature of systematic errors, could be a signature of fundamental physics, which would be very exciting, or could also be a fluke in principle. Right, the cut is in the map, but this is now averaged over all separations with angle theta. So there's always going to be separations with theta even up to 180 degrees, even if you cut the galaxy.
The shaded region, that's 1 sigma?
Yeah, that's 1 sigma. But remember, this is not as nice as looking at the angular power spectrum of the CMB where all the L's are uncorrelated in the full sky. Here, everything is very correlated in real space. But here, the point is not so much that the red is different from the blue. It's that the red is close to zero. That's kind of what's happening here. So it's really that it hugs zero very finely. All right, so that's been discussed a lot. And you can ask yourself the question, if the reason for this, this is a huge if the reason for this is the cut, some kind of cut in inflationary physics in the power, so that the power P of K vanishes above some scales, then could you see this in the large K structure? So imagine explanation for that, it's not clear it would be a good explanation, it's not clear it explains it well, but imagine that the cut in the power spectrum P of K is just, you know, phenomenologically that you don't have much power, you know, above 1,000 megaparsecs. So this is K less than 10 to the minus 3. So this is the usual Harrison-Zolovich spectrum. And this is the power spectrum with this that would, you know, alleviate these, the missing power. So could you notice this drop in power from the large case structure and therefore confirm or deny this potential explanation? We looked at this a year ago, and you know, if you look at the error bars for some future survey that are by hand put in here, but the, you know, the error bars are interesting, the answer from here is yes at many sigma. Then you read the fine print and you need not only this very large volume survey LSST, which will happen, but enormous number of redshifts, so three-dimensional information that will basically never be done. So as you could have guessed before doing the exercise, these CMB anomalies in large scales are very hard to check with large scale structure, because you need enormous volumes, but in principle, it's something you can aim for. And this.
You could presumably use photo Zs because these scales are huge and you don't care about the photo Z errors on those scales.
Ah, right. Yeah, we haven't done we haven't put in explicitly the photo Z errors and tried with that. So yeah, there's a question, how much do you use the photo Zs? Right, we haven't actually answered that question.
Are like 100 megaparsecs.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, intuitively you'd think so, but it's not, I don't think that's guaranteed to be the case, actually. So it's not, yeah, you'd think just from a hand-wavy argument that on such large scales you don't need the exact redshifts, but, you know, one would really have to do the analysis. And anyway, so it's pretty futuristic. That's a good question. What could you do in principle if you had photo Zs? Let me talk about the dipoles, which is a subject.
Yes. One more question about the,
yeah, sure.
The C of theta. So that's the large scale being having, you know, low correlations on large scale. Is that the same as just the quadrupole being low, or is it a different issue?
Ah, that's an excellent question. Most people lump those two together, but it's definitely not the same. People have talked about the low quadrupole, but quadrupole is not so low. Quadrupole is only low at maybe the 10% level, which is not even by, you know, the softest cosmology standards, it's not unusual. But really what happens is here, if you look, what do you need to do to arrange for power to be low in terms of multipoles, you need to arrange the quadrupole, the hexadecapole, and the next three or four guys to just kind of oscillate up and down in a way to make this. So in one of our papers, I think in our 2007 paper, we played this game. We said, okay, let's just, you know, think of this as a, like a, you know, equalizer for music and play with the first five, six CLs and see how well how much we need to tune them up or down to make C of theta to be this low or lower. And it turns out you have to go to L of 5 or 6, even mathematically, even if you have full freedom in playing with them, just to arrange for low power. So it's definitely not sufficient to kill the quadrupole. It won't do this. It's, you know, you need kind of low quadrupole, high octopole, low hexadecapole, and a few others to arrange for this. This is a potential hint that if this is real, and if you're building a theoretical model to explain it, it's the real space is a place, space to think in, not the multiple space, which most people do. Because it's really here that it becomes apparent.
Can the relate note then it's the alignment between the lower order moments related to this in any way? The
naively know, because I'm just going to come back to this picture, all of this alignment, so one can write all these multiples in an amplitude times the direction, roughly speaking. This is mostly to do with direction. That's mostly due to the amplitude. So they're not completely decoupled. When you work out the math, you see there's some coupling. It's not as clean as amplitude and direction, but it's pretty clean. So naively, you'd say there's no relation, but nobody knows for sure. Naively, this only tells you about directions of these higher multiples, and they are aligned. And that thing is telling you about the power, which in real space is suppressed. Okay, so that's the case. So now let me talk a little bit about the dipoles. And this is, when I started working on this, Cameron and I started working on this, this was so confusing. You'd think that dipole is one thing that we all know and understand, but I found this to be super confusing. I don't know, maybe it's just me. There's a bunch of different dipoles you have in cosmology, and very confusingly, people give them different names, also names that don't always make sense. So here's the names that I think do make sense that I would assign to these if I were rewriting the books. There's, first of all, local structure dipole. This is dipole due to the finite volume that we are in. And I'm going to show an illustration in a moment. But imagine you are looking at galaxies in some small region around you. There's some filament going through the rim region, some pancakes, some structures. And you're going to see this some dipole and all the higher multiples just because you're looking at a very finite piece of the universe. That's what we call local structure dipole. If you were to increase that volume far, far out to a redshift of infinity with infinitely many galaxies, you would presumably reach the intrinsic dipole, the primordial origin. This is a famous 10 to the minus 5 dipole. However, as we know from the CMB, this intrinsic dipole from inflation, that's presumably there, is usually completely swamped by kinematic dipole, which is due to our motion with the CMB. So this is one thing that we can all agree on. We are moving at some speed of several hundred kilometers a second relative to the CMB rest frame. And that's a dipole of 10 to the minus 3, V over C is 10 to the minus 3, which completely swamps this 10 to the minus 5. So here's a summary of those things. First of all, let's do the easy kinematic dipole. Kinematic is due to our motion. So relative to the CMB, measured very accurately to be 10 to the minus 3, V over C. And expected in the large case structure is, again, if the large case structure and CMB rest frames agree, you expect 10 to the minus 3 for sure. Intrinsic is more complicated. Intrinsic dipole in the CMB is 10 to the minus 5. That's the one we probably don't have hope of observing. And intrinsic in the large case structure is either, you know, this one, but usually the local structure one. So it could be 10 to the minus 5 if you had infinitely large survey with infinitely many galaxies, but it could be as large as unity if you're just looking in front of your nose and, you know, measuring dipole.
I guess I would have thought that the intrinsic dipole was the gate location. I mean,
Good point. I haven't thought about that. Good point. We are kind of not there yet in terms of probing it, but that's a good question.
Yeah.
Good point. Right. And for the kinematic dipole, here's some points that you don't have to read all this text, but you know, you've all heard it. So we are not, you know, our motion is some of different motions. Earth, we are, you know, our telescopes and such are Earth. Earth around the sun is 30 kilometers a second. Then, of course, sun is going around the galaxy is 220 kilometers a second. Then galaxy to the local group, 300 kilometers a second. Local group to the CMB is 600 kilometers a second. And very interestingly, local group to the CMB is almost the opposite direction than sun to the local group. So when you sum these two vectors, they are one vector of 300 and then one vector of minus 600. So the sum of those is three. That's why you get the sum of 370 in the winning direction. Okay. So this is the total. Of course, when we do the CMB experiment, we measure the total. And it is very, very well measured as far back as COBE, 370 kilometers a second in direction, super well measured. This is the sum of all the motions. What people are trying to do in large case structure is they are trying to look at our motion relative to large case structure and, you know, go to higher and higher redshift and they see if they converge to this value. So let me illustrate now the intrinsic dipole. Remember, that was kinematic. That was our motion. Now let me illustrate this one, which is the local structure dipole. And here's a picture I've had. If you have the universe and if you look at some volume, in this case, you expect a relatively large local structure power, including dipole. But when you integrate over larger volumes of space, as you look at galaxies farther and farther out, you average more and more, and you expect less. How much you expect can be straightforwardly calculated from theory. This is the same equation that goes in CAMB and similar codes. So multiples, this is multiple power, is integral over the power spectrum. This is pk cubed p of k. This is I squared of k is just some function which kind of tells you what kind of survey do you have. The integral part of that function is this basically the number density of galaxies multiplied by the bias, because they are biased traces of large-scale structure, and then there's the growth function and so on. So this is, in principle, straightforward. This is a full formula for predicting how much angular power, this is a projected quantity, do you see depending on, you know, what kind of primordial power spectrum do you have and what kind of survey do you have that enters here. We are going to be interested in L of 1 alone, dipoles. So the number density of objects is modulated like this. This is a dipolar modulation. And this coefficient A is related to C1. Roughly speaking, C1 is A squared. This is amplitude, that's power. So for the dipole, they're very simply related. Also, cosmic variance error tells us that the error on CL is equal to this famous formula. So for the dipole, this is also easy to show. Easy to calculate, that is. So here's the predictions for the full power spectrum. Remember, L of 1 is dipole, but these are all of the multiples for large-scale structure. This is how much power you expect as a function of multiple. So this is about 1 degree on the sky. This is very large, very small scales. You can see it's mostly virtualist power spectrum. It's a projected quantity. You integrate along the line of sight. And the one interesting thing to notice is as you go to higher redshift, maybe counterintuitively, you don't get more power. You get less power. The reason for that is as you go to higher z, you integrate more and more, so you simply get less signal. So if you integrate it out to z infinity, and if you had galaxies there, which I didn't assume, then you might have a chance to drop to that level of 10 to the minus 5 squared, which is 10 to the minus 10. But in general, you stop somewhere else. And also, you have to make sure, if you do these predictions, to use the full approximation, not something called the Limber approximation, which you see most of the time. So the full thing is actually dashed in this case. And most of the time, it doesn't matter which one you use. Cosmological constraints come from here. But in this particular case, we'll care. So we have the full expression for the prediction. So we can predict, given the depth of the survey, and given n of z of galaxies in the distribution, we can predict how much power. We can't predict the direction, but we can predict the power. But here's that illustrated just a tiny bit more. Here's an amplitude of the power of the dipolar modulation as a function of z max. So this is, you can see, for a pretty shallow survey. But as you integrate more and more, in this particular case, you don't go down to very small levels. The reason is that I assume that you run out of galaxies in this particular case beyond somewhere here. So if you don't have any more galaxies, you will converge to some value that's actually quite large relative to 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 3 even. So this is the type of thing you see. The yellow band will be cosmic variance in all this. And the blue line is the theoretical prediction given geometry of the survey. OK, so if you read the literature, you'll see a ton of stuff about dipoles in astrophysics-oriented literature. This is also very confusing. They're using what to me is confusing language. But basically, this is what's happening. In linear theory of perturbation theory, velocity and acceleration fields are related through this rather famous equations. Here, f is just d log growth, d log a, the scale factor. So this is a famous factor from like people's books and such. So people measure the acceleration g. And then presumably, at least also according to this position, is if you are accelerated towards some position in the universe, then you will have velocity in that same direction as well. Well, gravitational acceleration just equal to this. You have to divide by the bias because this is rho. You need the mass, so rho divided by bias is the mass. Or this is density of galaxies. And so this is you have to weight each galaxy's mass divided by distance squared. Masses are just about the hardest things to get in astronomy. So instead of mass, you write it as mass over luminosity times luminosity. Now you assume that m over l ratio is constant, or constant maybe for a type of object you're considering. And of course, luminosity over 4 pi distance squared is just the flux, in this case, unfortunately, called SSI. So now you see, if you assume that m over l is a constant, maybe even better if you know what m over l on average is, you can weight each galaxy's location by its flux. And this is what people, when people talk about what we would call a flux-weighted dipole, right? That's what they're trying to get. So they try to get g and then get v. And then as they integrate this to larger and larger distances of 20, 50, 100 megaparsecs, they always ask the question, is this direction converging to the CMB dipole direction or not? And it's a very messy answer to that, but the short answer is yes, apparently. You know, the two are, as you integrate deeper, the two agree more and more. So this is what people do in the literature, which is not what we'll do in this work. Now, this, I'm a little bit fuzzy about all the possibilities that, you know, because I was saying if you integrate in large-scale structure deeper and deeper, you should get the same kinematic, certainly dipole, as the CMB, because the rest frame of the CMB is the same of the rest frame of large-scale structure. But this is not necessarily the case. And in the remaining of my stay here, I'd actually like to hear more from I think most people here know more than I do, about how could that even happen that the two rest frames disagree. The most apparent possible reason is the so-called Grischuk-Zeldovich effect, where you have a very long wavelength perturbations, or a single modal perturbation, and you can have the same thing in quintessence, which via integrated Sachs-Wolfe at late times, it can also impart this. So I believe in this case, you would have a disagreement between the two rest frames. Isocurvature perturbations would do a similar kind of thing. And I'm not sure, I'll find out more this day, that bubble collisions actually would have, talking to Matt Kleban at a workshop in Aspen recently, that to a very small effect, but these are potential ways to have the two rest frames disagree. So that's not guaranteed by any means, though that's, of course, what we expect, that, you know, at large-scale structure rest frame agrees with the CMB rest frame. So this is also provides some motivation for empirically checking for dipoles from the large-scale structure. So in this work, we are looking at the number. We are not weighting with flux. We are not weighting with any of that stuff. We are just looking at the number density of galaxies and other objects in different directions. Here we have, you can have intrinsically more galaxies in one direction than the other, like that intrinsic dipole. Or you can have, you have a kinematic dipole if you have motion, then you have a relativistic aberration. The number density will go as 1 plus 2 v over c times cosine of the angle between the dipole direction, between the kinematic direction where you're moving, and the direction you're looking in. This is from just from relativity. The factor of 2 comes from the fact that in the area element sine theta d phi, sine theta d phi gets one factor, 1 plus beta cosine. And d theta gets another factor. So when you square it into first order, you get twice that factor. So this is a kind of thing you see due to the kinematic. And I know this is all 10 to the minus 3. This is always, if you have kinematics, everything is a several hundred kilometers a second in cosmology. So it's always of order 10 to the minus 3. And we do have enough galaxies, if we look deep enough, that we can potentially probe this. Okay. So here's the methodology. So notice that's a kind of a different approach, and in my mind, much cleaner approach, though it's really fundamentally different. I don't know that it's better or worse, just different than weighting galaxies with fluxes. This is just looking at the number density. You don't have to know anything about their masses or lights or anything like that. Methodology comes from this paper by Chris Hirata, which he worked out exactly how you'd want to do this. So again, this is the same equation I wrote before. Delta of n is amplitude of the dipole times direction. This is unit vector of direction of the dipole, dotted into direction you're looking in. And this is just the fact that you might have some systematics. Ki is the coefficient, and ti is the template of a systematic. And here's what I mean by template. Imagine you have some pattern on the sky, some systematic pattern, like, say, dust. Then ti is the map of that dust. This is a map of the dust in direction n, and this is of ith component of dust. And each of those templates will have a coefficient ki. So by including them explicitly, you can either subtract them if you know their magnitudes, or you can just marginalize over all values of the coefficient in front, and you can still get good results. This in cosmology is a, you know, in sort of a more observational type, is a very well-known procedure. You can marginalize over a finite number of nuisance parameters and still get good results. This is motivated by various other work where temperature and anisotropies in the CMB have a so-called multiplicative modulations, and power spectrum also have a multiplicative modulation. So I think I've told about motivation already, but this is really what we're after. We are after dipoles. And so again, Chris Hirata developed this formalism, and this is beautiful. It's really, people have done this before, but I don't think in a way this elegant and foolproof as Hirata showed, which is that say you have this vector x. A vector x has components of the dipole, And now for the moment, these three are not, they're not normalized, so the amplitude is some of their squares. And then you have any systematics, and don't worry about this, I didn't mention it so far, this is some offset. And you can solve for x, this is your solution for x, given this matrix and this vector. This is the Fisher matrix, you create a random map, and in that random map you have your fluctuations in number, which are unfortunately called t here. So you'd operate this on your random Poisson map, and then you have a combination of your data map and your random map, and you get this GI. So this is basically, you know, here your error bar, your errors on x are given by F inverse. This is your Fisher matrix. So this inverse is errors on x, and this is your solution for x. So this is how you get the dipole, and then you can do whatever you like. You can marginalize over the templates, or you can even marginalize over directions of the dipole and just ask about amplitude, and that's also very easy to do. You can, you can get everything very easily using this. And it doesn't care about sky cuts. Sky cuts just means you avoid some part of the sky in both your random and your data. It's, you know, kind of manifestly optimal, I would say. You can say that. So here's some results, very preliminary. So it may, you know, not everything is fully worked out, but just to show some results. Let me just first ask if there's any questions about anything I've said so far here before I jump to the surveys.
Sorry, yeah, let me just ask. So A is just a parameter measuring the this effect, this relativistic effect you're talking about?
It could be relativistic, yeah, right.
I mean, it's on the previous slide. The
whatever the cause is.
Okay, so you're obviously putting in the angular dependence. Are you?
It's just the dipole, yeah. Yes, that's here. So remember, so this is A from theory. C1 is A squared. So C1 is the multiple 1 CL of multiple 1. And there's a relation that A is amplitude, this is power. So C1 is basically A squared. So I take square root of this, so there's a 4 pi over 9 or something. So it's this. So if I know the depth of the survey, and if I know N of Z, then from this equation, you know, N of Z comes here, and then everything follows for the standard lambda CDM model. But that's not where the uncertainty is. The uncertainty is all in knowing the survey and the bias and all that.
So does that C1 include the relativistic aberration?
Let me think about that. Does it include? So I think the answer is no, because it's good to go to this list. Relativistic aberration would be due to kinematic, while the theory is a combination of these two, really intrinsic, like P of K, which is 10 to the minus 5 squared, and then local structure, you know, this will be significantly bumped due to the fact you're looking at the vocal. So the theory is a combination of these two. The word relativistic aberration goes with the kinematic. So the answer is no. So here's another way how to think about that now that you are, because it's a good question. Imagine I have all these possibilities. Imagine I look at a very shallow survey, and most of my surveys will be shallow, where you expect dipole of 10 to the minus 2, so the CE1 is 10 to the minus 4. Then it doesn't matter. This relativistic effect will be negligible, because it's 10 to the minus 3, and this is 10 to the minus 2 or less. So there I don't have to worry about it. But if I have a very deep survey, then my finite volume effect is small, then I have a chance to detecting velocity. Good question. Any other? Because now I'm going to show survey results. So theory is very straightforward here. But
one other comment, of course, there's K corrections and other things other than simply the relativistic effects, right? I mean, if you're moving, right, then there are K correction type effects because let's imagine there's a shell at rest and we're moving it with respect to that distant shell. Then when we observe in a given filter, for example, we're not seeing the same rest frame part of the spectrum on this side of the sky as we are on that side of the sky. Right, so that adds other corrections.
That's right.
Similar order, I would guess.
You're right. And your point, though in a different language, has been addressed in one of these papers that's working this out. This has to do with, I think they frame it in terms of the faint end of the luminosity function. I won't be able to think about this clearly right now, but the fact that...
Yeah, astronomers would call it K-correction.
Okay. Yeah. those words alone, yeah, I'd have to think about that.
Correction,
yeah,
to the observed frame of your bands and the rest frame. There's this very tiny shifts, right?
So you're saying things will leave your band. We'll leave your band, is that
yeah,
what you're saying?
You'll sample different parts of the spectrum, slightly different parts of the spectrum. For identical galaxies, you'll sample, in the same filter, you'll sample slightly different parts of the rest frame spectrum. On this side of the sky as on that.
That's right,
side
but
side.
If you don't
and
care...
that will change the fluxes.
Oh.
And that will affect how many objects come into your sample because you have a flux on the sample.
Ah, okay, yes, thank you. That's clear. I was about to say we don't do fluxes, but of course, there's always some limitation. So yes, that's right. Good, thanks. All right, so now let me show a few things. And the nice thing here is you can here be completely phenomenological. You don't even have to have galaxies. What about gamma ray bursts? So here's a Betsy survey on, I hope I got this right, because I was kind of writing this slide last minute. Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, I hope I got the telescope right. But yeah, Betsy, gamma ray bursts, about 3,000, although for reasons I never fully understood, only about 1,600 are available to do cosmology with them. This is a distribution of Betsy bursts, and no reason to believe why this wouldn't be a fair representation of structure in the universe. We don't know what the redshifts of these are, by and large. But it's okay. Remember, we are doing, we just have to, for theoretical prediction, we just have to have some kind of idea forever. Here, things will be so rough, you'll see it doesn't matter so much. The really nice thing about this is you don't see the structure of the galaxy here. The GRBs are transparent to our galaxy, which is a little bit unusual once you play with these things. So you can use actually the full sky. There's only 1,600 objects, but that's okay. And here are the results. This is the observed amplitude. And this is if just for fun you start cutting around the galaxy center. So maybe just look at this lowest one, even though you can start cutting around the galactic plane. The reason for that is a little bit, that there's things called soft gamma ray repeaters that live in the galaxy, might confuse. Okay, whatever. So just look maybe at this. So this is the amplitude. I'm not showing theoretical prediction. Because the GRBs go rather deep, theoretical prediction is, I think it's a order 10 to the minus 2 for amplitude. It's 10 to the minus 4 in power. And here's the results are consistent with zero, and these are 1 and 2 sigma error bars. So you see that the error bars are about factor of 10, turns out too big to detect this order 0.01, which is due to the finite, of course, very finite density of the GRBs, 1,600 objects total. But this is still kind of nice that this can be used for cosmological purposes and, in principle test, for any dipolar modulation. That's... This is the angle. So I'm glad you asked because I'm going to be showing this. This is the thing, and this is a galactic plane. And the angle that you cut is 2b cut. So b cut is around each side of the equator in galactic coordinates. So if b cut were 90 degrees, you would have cut the whole sky. Nothing would be left. B cut, so this is cutting more and more around the galactic plane. Does that make sense? So just because there might be some contamination even in this case.
But we know that the gamma ray bursts can see from the through the galaxy. So
yes, but there's other, soft gamma ray repeaters that might masquerade as other objects that might masquerade as gamma ray bursts inside the galaxy. So even though you can see through the galaxy to see the GRBs, there's other sources that may potentially contaminate. You saw every single GRB. But you also got some extra stuff, potentially. So to prevent from that, this is a check. Of course, the error bars blow up as you do that. But here's another one, two micron. This is a famous two micron all sky survey. Observed 99.998% of the sky at 3 micron type wavelengths. There's point source catalog with a gazillion point sources, but many of them are in the galaxy. That's not very useful. Then you go to extended source catalog, which is about 1.6 million extra galactic sources. Mean redshift is 0.05 to 0.07, depending on which color cut you take. Typically, the fainter you go, the deeper you go. But notice, this is kind of a typical galaxy redshift. You run out at Z of 0.15 in all cases. So this is still very, for cosmologists, this is very shallow. Notice redshifts are not known. Redshift distribution is known, but not the redshifts. So here's the results for 2MES, like I said, preliminary, graphs not user-friendly and so on, but just to show. So this is two different cuts. This is fainter. This is brighter. And these are theoretical predictions. For fainter, one is deeper. So theoretical prediction is, this is brighter. So theoretical, so this is shallower. So you expect more amplitude than you will expect in a deeper sample. This is the theoretical expectation from the S1 alpha CL. This is a cosmic variance error bar. As you cut more and more around the galactic plane, you remember there's F sky in the cosmic variance, so this grows. One thing you always notice with these is the cosmic variance errors are much bigger than the measurement errors. The measurement errors are these little errors on the green line. The green is the measurement. And you always measure it better than the cosmic variance. You have to, of course, take both into account. And you see there's good agreement. Yellow is one sigma, so there's very good agreement between the two. Nothing there. And you know, this is, again, the power isn't all that strong, but it's a good kind of consistency check of the cosmology. So you do measure, what do you measure here? You measure large signal that's completely dominated by the local structure dipole, the fact that you have finite amount of structure. You are nowhere near even detecting the 10 to the minus 3 kinematic dipole, right? That would be 10 to the minus 3 amplitude. Any questions about this? Now, the survey that just got completed recently, two-mass redshift survey, or 2MRS. So this is a redshift survey, by and large, done by John Hackrach, who is a well-known astronomer at Harvard, who passed away just last year. And he devoted, and others devoted, I think, like two decades to doing this. As far as I can tell, this is what we'd call old-fashioned astronomy. This is people going to mountaintops, taking spectrum, microspectrum individually, different people, different mountains, different years, until you get hit 140,000, 40, which is quite a large number. So this is a subset of the two mass, is a redshift survey, and of course it's still brighter. So this is still brighter. This scale shows you how deep. This is V over C stopping at 0.07. That's to say velocity is less than 20,000 kilometers a second. That's to say the redshift's definitely below 0.1. And just to illustrate one, this is the number distribution of sources. So this is the full, the faint or the deepest two mass. This is two mass if you only look at brighter objects and you're a little bit safer because brighter turns out to be safer in this case. And then this is a redshift survey. So the redshift survey is still lower redshift. You see it's a pretty low Z. So these are the four slices. They have what they call them onion skins in the Hacker paper. They have four slices, and I forgot exactly what ranges are these. I think it's 0 to 0.02 redshift, 0.02 to 0.04. I'm making up a number slightly because I don't remember exactly. This is like 0.04 to 0.07, and this is 0.07 to 0.1, and already you see you're running out of objects a little bit. So they have redshifts, and you can take, you know, you can look at any slice individually, or you can look at, you know, all in totality. So here, this first plot is looking at integrating out to Z max, or you know, 0.1 is the most, but you can stop integrating out to galaxies at some Z. This is the expected dipole, all local structure dipole with the error bars, and this is a measurement, and notice now measurements have very small error bars. Again, there's good agreement, they are one sigma relative to each other. So this is if you only, now you have to cut their galaxies emitting an infrared, you have to cut. If you keep Z max of 0.1, but start cutting more and more, then you get some, again, some trend that agrees, so amplitude agrees with the theory. And yeah, here you see that same effect as before. Because you run out of galaxies, you're not going to converge to anything like you know, not going to fall down lower. This is directions, by the way, of this two-mass dipole. So it's good to look at the directions in this map that shows our sky and galactic coordinates. First of all, there's a famous CMB dipole that's our kinematic, our motion to the CMB rest frame. This is a tiny error bar. You can't even see it. It's here somewhere. And now there's two different other kinds of dipoles. There's the dipole that we obtained, which is here with the errors. And there's a flux-weighted dipole. Remember, this is measuring V. And this is measuring, this is local structure. And then this is measuring acceleration G. So this is weighting by, galaxies by flux. This is not weighting. This is weighting with flux. And you'd expect, roughly speaking, that these two agree, that you know, our, just looking at the number density of galaxies, you know, where you see more structure, you are expected to see more acceleration. So you'd expect these two to agree. It is a little bit of an accident that those two agree with the CMB. Because remember, there's a sum of all motions. And if we are looking at It's due to the fact that sun's motion to the local group is almost exactly the opposite of local group to the galaxy. So more generally, you'd expect these two to be anywhere else relative to the CMB, and they just happen to be relatively close to the CMB. Anyways, this is just trying to see. You can also look at different cuts in your surveys and trying to see how your direction works around the sphere. This is marginalized. And the one final example I'll give is maybe the most powerful survey. This is NRAO VLA, Sky Survey, or NVSS. This surveyed 82% of the sky. This is a radio survey, 82% of the sky at 1.4 gigahertz, and has enormous number of sources, 1.8 million. Though this survey has a really scary looking declination dependent striping, so it has stripes that I'm not showing because everyone would get scared if you saw. If you saw them, if you take the faintest objects, so you take brighter objects, and then it goes away. Do people know what in cosmology what this survey is notable for? Anybody knows by chance? It's played an important role.
ISW.
This is, I believe, the first ISW detection is cross correlation of NRAO galaxies and the CMB. And also, more recently, it's been used to detect lensing of the CMB, I believe, also as a cross correlation between NRAO and WMAP. So in cosmology, it's been used. Why is it nice? Because it's quite deep. Redshifts are like 0.7, typical redshift. It covers 3/4 of the sky. And well, those are two huge things, deep and covers a lot of the sky. You have to cut out the galaxy, by the way, galactic plane, in addition to this blob missing that's not observed. VLA is in the northern hemisphere. Extremely preliminary results. Here's our, now you see we go down lower. We measure. Here's the amplitude prediction, which I don't have, actually, sorry, I don't have a prediction. I have a measurement of the amplitude as a function of flux limits. So this is if you limit the flux. This is going more aggressive, going fainter. This is less aggressive. And Blake and Wall, turns out, they get different results. We understand why this is. They remove some local structures by hand, saying we only want the far away things. So they get less power. But we say, no, in fact, keep everything. We have prediction for everything, so just keep it. And you would expect, because now the expected signal for this survey is small enough that we expect 3/4 of this signal to be kinematic in origin. So if the CMB and large structure rest frames agree, then you expect these two to agree. And you can see pretty big error bars on the galactic L and B directions. And this is a CMB direction, and it's, you know, within 2 sigma. So like I said, this is very preliminary. I'm not going to, you know, read too much into it. But roughly speaking, it seems to obey what we expect. So systematics, let me just say one thing. So here's different templates you can do, and we are doing that right now. We've been doing it all along. The long story short, this doesn't change much. You have various emissions in our galaxy that you can marginalize over. Or even more interestingly, you have different exposure functions. Coverage or exposure function means you look more in one direction of the sky. So you integrate longer, you go to lower fluxes, and you see more objects. So you have to correct for that, or else, you know, marginalize over this template. That's important to take into account. And Chris Hirata has done that in his work as well. He's, in my mind, pioneered, you know, the way to do this in this context at least. So I've talked about statistical isotropy of the universe as one of the really good things you can check with large scale structure. And I've shown current constraints on dipoles that were admittedly pretty weak, but they agree with the standard picture. But why is this interesting in the future? Because we will have a very large volume surveys. So some of you may have seen this movie. My computer doesn't have enough RAM, so it's a bit jagged. But here, this is a Sloan Digital Size Survey flyout movie. We are in here. We are flying out. And these are galaxies in the sky. These are Sloan galaxies. These are Sloan quasars. This picture is more or less to scale. So this in moving coordinates is to scale. And Sloan only covers like, you know, 10,000 square degrees, and it's pretty shallow. You really have to look at this denser part. That's, by and large, that's Sloan. These are quasars there are much fewer of. So we will improve a lot upon Sloan and already are doing now. And then we'll have a chance to map out a good part of the volume of the Hubble sphere. So some of the things are coming up. First of all, let me show the first notable large-scale structure survey, the Harvard CFA survey, is smaller than this triangle. I just made it bigger because the triangle could not be seen. This is a famous stick man from 1980. And that's this tiny or smaller. So that will explore a really small part of the universe. But already a dark energy survey that's being constructed and starting operation this year. This is a new camera on a 4-meter telescope in Chile. The camera built by Fermilab, Michigan is taking part in it and others. This is going to be kind of like Sloan, but 3 times deeper, roughly speaking, in terms of redshift reach. I'm doing these wedges. They're really three-dimensional things. There are many, many other things to be said about these surveys, but just to show the volumes roughly, they are going to cover a lot more. Then a little bit more in the future, Big Boss, this is powerful. It's a spectroscopic survey, so tens of millions of galaxies covering a large chunk of the sky. This is Cerro Tololo in Chile. This is Mayal telescope in Arizona. And that's going to give a three-dimensional picture of both galaxies and Lyman alpha sources. Then LSST, this is the mother of all ground-based telescopes, starting about 2018 in Chile also. This is going to do weak lensing. Galaxies cover half the sky, get many, many sources, though no redshifts. This is all redshifts. This is, you have to do redshift follow-up here and here to get the full 3D information. And finally, the painful yet still ongoing story with what's now called Euclid. Europeans took the lead in building the mission to probe dark energy and cover a large chunk of the sky. And the Americans dropped the ball, unfortunately, for the moment, though there's still something called WFIRST that would unite dark energy studies and microlensing studies. And that would be, you know, my children would be really good at building it, I think, and will be, since it's happening in a really unspecified future. But Euclid is supposed to go ahead. And like I said, painful story, but this survey, more expensive than the others, would be quite a lot more powerful than the others because, you know, though for the tests I talked about, maybe not as much. But for some other things like weak lensing, it would be. And then there's a little bit more, potentially very powerful, but more speculative, more difficult in terms of systematic techniques like 21 centimeter mapping that have potential to cover very large chunks of the universe. So in conclusion, I talk about large-scale structure as a great tool to test fundamental physics beyond the cosmological parameters, and particularly compared to the CMB. So any type, WMAP and then Planck, all of these anomalies alignments, you can check with large-scale structure. You can test them. So far, these relatively modest in power tests are consistent with the standard picture. And with the new surveys, we'd expect much better constraints. And I think in general, we expect large-scale structure to become a much more prominent player. In my conversations with theorists, they're generally aware of the CMB and not large-scale structure as a probe of fundamental physics. And I think that's changing. Thank you. Yeah, GRB is the amplitude measured.
But the direction.
Oh. I don't have a slide, nor do I remember, but the amplitude measured is, two orders of magnitude. I mean, it's consistent with zero, and the error bar is 2 orders of magnitude bigger than the CMB. So it's going to be, there should be no relation a priori, right? It's because there's so few GRBs, you kind of get large errors. You need much, much higher density to really pin it down. So the measurement errors are way too big to say any comparison. You know, you're comparing 0 plus minus 0.1 to 10 to the minus 3 to some non-zero number plus minus 10 to the minus 3. So too big error. Errors are too big. Yeah.
Just a comment. I think depth information is important. Talked about the two dipoles, you know, this kinematic effect with the relativity plus k correction plus everything else, plus large scale structure along the line of sight, and we'd ideally like to separate those things, right? So the Blake and Wall approach is actually, if you want to measure the kinematic effect and find the rest frame, the ultimate, you know, are we at rest with respect to this distant shell? You do want to try to throw out all the nearby stuff if you can, because that's causing. That's contaminating your kinematic dipole with the structure.
I see.
Dipole.
Yeah.
So I think that was their goal.
I see. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. That was clearly the goal in their paper, right? They are trying to subtract the local to only be left with a.
Which is hard to do, right? Unless you have redshifts for everything, you really know where different things are. But I think with photos ease, you can do a lot of that. Right? So you can imagine big sky surveys, and you use the photos ease to throw out the nearby stuff, or at least to separate them into two different dipoles. You should be able to see whether you're really at rest with respect to them.
That's a good point. That's a very good point, yes.
It's nice to look at both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that will test these intrinsic, wacky isocurvature fluctuation scenarios. You want to be able to really see if there is a problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess our implicit logic here was we integrate out, and if we go deep enough, the local structure will average out. But you are saying another line of thought is actually just cut the local structure, and you might even do better. And I'm not sure immediately. I can't think of if you do better or not, but that's a good point, yeah.
Any other questions?